Have you ever struggled with fear in your life? Have you ever had the thought that I am not brave? Well, I'm here today to tell you that you are. Welcome to the Brave Podcast. I'm your host, Alexis Newland, and I'm so glad that you're tuning in here today. Each week, a friend and I get together and share stories of what makes them brave. So sit back, relax, enjoy your favorite cup of coffee or tea, and get ready for some engaging conversation. And remember, no matter what your story is, you are brave. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Brave Podcast. I am so happy that you guys are here today. My guest this week is Tim Davis. Tim is an author, a teacher, triathlete, and he likes to call himself the tripolar triathlete. The reason why is that he has bipolar disorder, and he used that as a way to cope with having the diagnosis and the illness. He also goes into depth about his long trial of addiction and how he overcame that. Now he's using his story as a way to advocate for mental health and to reach others out there, letting them know that they are not alone. I absolutely loved talking to Tim. It was really fun, and I think you guys will really be inspired and encouraged by his story. So without further ado, here is my interview with Tim Davis. Thank you so much for reaching out and asking to be a guest. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I've kind of been on a podcast circuit for a while since I wrote my book, which I published, self-published in July. And the title of your podcast is perfect because it kind of took me 19 years to get brave enough to kind of tell my story. So I figured the Brave podcast would be perfect. So.
Cool. Very cool. And I got to tell you, I have done triathlons too. I love to run. I struggled with my own mental health issues and I found that running was awesome. Yeah. It just helped so much. I struggle with depression a lot. So when I run, all of that kind of goes away. And I did a triathlon in 2018 and I'm not 40 yet, but my goal is at 40 to do Ironman. That's the goal that I'm shooting for. Cool. All right. Well, this is Alexis Newland and you're listening to the Brave Podcast. And my guest today is Tim. So Tim, introduce yourself. Tell people why you're awesome.
Hi, my name's Tim. Thanks for having me here. I'm happy to be on the Brave Podcast with you. Why am I awesome? Because I'm still alive.
Yeah.
And I have a wonderful wife and three kids. And there were definitely some dark moments early in my life where I came close to death quite a few times. And I hopefully don't have to revisit those. So.
Yeah. Where are you in California?
Yeah, I'm right next to Los Angeles in Alhambra, California.
Okay. I'm in Fresno.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're all Pacific Standard Time Zone.
Yeah, that is really nice.
Are you Yosemite?
I am. I just went there last weekend. Yeah. No, 2 weekends ago, and it snowed on us. It was
that's awesome.
Beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've only been there a couple of times. Last time I was there, it snowed. It was great. It's really pretty. It's too crowded in the summer.
It is. And so you're a triathlete. I got to ask you, have you ever done the Bass Lake Triathlon up in Yosemite?
I have not. Oh. That sounds really cool, though.
It's a good one. It was my first one that I did. We were all beginners. I remember kicking myself on the bike part because Bass Lake is super hilly. And when you're driving it, you don't realize it until you're on a bike. When you're like, we practice all of our distance biking on flat surfaces. What were we thinking? So like you're either crawling or flying down the hill. It was crazy.
Yeah, I can relate with that. Like I trained for several of my first triathlons, mostly on, you know, the flat bike trails around here in Los Angeles. And then the first half iron I did with, and there's a lot of mountains and roads like 100 years old. And it's like, got all this crack pavement and potholes. And there were like three people who crashed and two ambulance driving up and down the course. It was scary. I'm like, what am I doing? I was praying to God. Because I saw one dude that crashed and he was on the ground and there was like blood coming out of his head. His helmet was off. I'm like, what's going on?
Wow.
That was scary. Yeah. Wow. And that was my first half Ironman and I kept doing them.
Wow. So we're kind of getting into your story and what led you to triathlon. So tell people about your story and what got you to becoming a triathlete.
Okay. Well, how much time do we have? I know how many details I got.
We have an hour.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Well, my story, let's see. I was born in 1974 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, I'm from Atlanta.
Hey, I moved when I was three years old, so I don't really remember. I have one like memory of a little bike crash. Okay. And we live in this cul-de-sac neighborhood, actually in Decatur.
So. Okay, I know exactly where it is, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then we moved around a little bit, but we finally settled in southern West Virginia. and I lived there for about 5 years. And then when I was 8, we moved to northern West Virginia. I am one of 7 children, big okay. Catholic family.
Okay.
I'm the 3rd oldest. And I say I got my oldest sister and my older brother who are like 4 and 5 years older than me. And then I got a little sister and 3 little brothers.
Okay.
And see what else. Growing up in West Virginia, there wasn't a whole lot to do. We went to Catholic school. My mom made sure we went to Catholic school, big Catholic family. I was an altar boy for 8 years. And let's see, I guess, you know, not much to do in West Virginia. And I'm 8 years old and my older brother's 12 years old. And he discovers alcohol and okay. he introduces alcohol to me. And that's a big part of my story. Alcoholism runs in the family. Okay. I mean, as an 8-year-old, I didn't know it. I just wanted to be cool like my older brother. So he's yeah. like, here, drink this. And I know it made me feel good, you know, because I was always an anxious kid. And when I drank alcohol, my anxiety went away. I didn't know it at the time. I just knew that I like just felt uncomfortable and like nervous at school. Like kids were judging me and like I didn't fit in. Mm-hmm. And when I drank alcohol, like all that went away. And I was like, you know, let's do this. I was like the life of the party. It was all good. I didn't care what people thought of me. Yeah. It made all those insecurities and inhibitions go away. So, you know, as an 8-year-old, I obviously wasn't doing it every day. But okay. I was looking for every chance.
At 8. Wow.
Yeah, at 8. I know. And at 9 years old, he introduced me to that wacky tobacco, as they called it back then, marijuana.
Yeah.
And I like that even more. Go figure, you know, because I'm an addict too, not just an alcoholic. And let's see, when I was 13, our family had this big tragic event where my dad was playing chase with me and my sister, and he chased me under our balcony, and I ran down the balcony and ran back into the house, and he ran down the balcony, and he was like big guy, 5'9", 250 pounds, you know, kind of overweight, and he tripped and fell off the balcony and landed head first.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And, you know, I was halfway downstairs. We had a 2-story home and I heard my sister scream because she was kind of falling behind. And I kind of just knew something was wrong. And I ran out to the driveway and there he was on the driveway. I was the first one to see him and his neck was all swelled up and he had like a gash from his forehead to the back of his head. And he was pretty much lifeless, you know. And, you know, I freaked out and yelled, called 911. My neighbors came out, my mom came out and my sister came out and they was just like, you know,
chaos.
Panic hit. Yeah, it was chaos. And my mom was giving my 3 little baby brothers a bath. They were only 2, 3, and 5 years old at the time. So she was doing bath time with the little babies, my 3 little brothers. And my older brother and sister weren't home. They were at their McDonald's jobs, you know, so they could earn money to buy designer clothes. Because, you know, from big family, 7 kids, my parents said, if you want designer clothes, you got to get your own
job. You got to get your own job, yeah.
Because we went to the thrift store, you know, to buy clothes. And I got hand-me-downs. You know, my older brother got the new clothes. The rest of us got the hand-me-downs. So anyway, that was a crazy night. And my dad ended up being in a coma for 8 months before he expired.
Wow.
And it was a long, tragic 8 months. And after that night, or actually late that night, my brother came home. And it was like 3 a.m. when he got home because he went to the hospital from his work shift. And he proceeded to beat me up and blame me. Our dad's going to die because of you. I don't know how clean this podcast is, but he used like a lot of cuss words when he was beating me up. And he beat me up for like an hour, you know, like you effing killed our dad. Our dad's going to effing die because of you. And I'm 13 and I'm young. And
that's heavy burden to carry.
Yeah. And, you know, and he proceeded to beat me up really bad. He almost put me in the hospital that night. And that went on for a long time. And I just was in the fetal position while he was kicking and punching. And he kind of threw me into every wall in the room. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was really traumatized.
Yeah.
At the time, I just wanted it to stop. But then for a long time after that, I really thought it was my fault. But my brother, he wanted to make it up to me later. Let's smoke some weed. Let's drink some beer. Let's get along. We had this love-hate relationship. Basically, if I did anything better than him, he would beat me up. If I did anything that he didn't like, he'd beat me up. But then later he'd be like, I'm sorry, Tim, here, let's drink some weed, or let's drink some booze and smoke some weed and we'll make it all better. And so now, having been sober 13 and a half years and having been through rehab several times because I'm a slow learner and having been through lots of therapy, I realized back then that I was seeking to drink and smoke weed and do drugs to escape painful feelings and hurt, physical pain and emotional pain and trauma. And that's how I was processing it back then. Because my mom never sought any therapy for any of us. She didn't really believe in therapy. Mental health wasn't, something that our family ever considered as an option or that we would need. I think the mentality of my family was that you were weak if you needed, you know, to see a psychologist or psychotherapist. This is back in the late 80s. That's how things went on. I always got good grades in school. But when it came time to go to college, I applied to the local university because I thought I was going to stay there. But then my girlfriend dumped me on my 18th birthday, which was in June. And then I was like, well, it's time to get out of here. I can get away from my abusive older brother. I can start new. And the other school I applied to was the University of Southern California. My mom and my older sister encouraged me to go out there. And luckily I got in, and it was cheaper. It was a lot cheaper back then.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, it's super expensive now.
Oh, yeah. It costs like five times as much now as when I went there. Yeah. And I went there on almost full financial aid, because after my dad died, we went from a middle income family to a lower income family. Because my mom had to work full time, but she was like basically a teacher. Well, she went to become a paralegal, but she was supporting seven kids and she was still putting us in Catholic school. She worked her butt off to keep the house. My mom was never the same after my dad died.
I can imagine to lose your husband and then have seven kids to take care of.
Yeah. And then her dad died just a couple months later too. So that was just a really rough year. She lost her husband and her dad in the same year, and he was stranded with seven kids. She was just never the same. Before he died, she was much more loving and tolerant. Occasionally the firm hand came out. She usually saved the discipline for my dad. There was corporal punishment discipline in our household from our parents, but I thought it was within reason, because me and my older brother were pretty rambunctious. We got in a lot of trouble. And anyway, after he died, whenever we did something wrong, she was like quick to cuss at us all the time and threaten to flush our heads down the toilet bowl. She just was like, seemed like an angry woman, and it was all about business. Before he died, she had time for us. She had patience. She had love. She had tolerance. But after he died, it was just like, did you do your homework? Did you do your chores? Okay. And she was done with us. And that's the way it seemed for me in high school. She didn't have a lot of time to really kind of just, I don't know, build bonding relationships, if you will, and all that kind of stuff. And I can't blame her. I mean, God,
she was hurting herself.
Yeah, I have three kids, and I can't imagine if my wife died how I'd manage just with three of them. Two of them are already in college. I went to college to get away from there and to start new fresh. Unfortunately, my alcoholism and my addiction came along to USC with me. And I continued to become a daily, you know, drinker and weed smoker all through college, and somehow managed to pull off a 3.3 at USC. I met my wife to be my freshman year, and we started dating. We lived in the same dorm. And we started dating at the end of the year. We became friends first. We hung out a lot. And then sophomore year, we moved in together. And then junior year, we realized that was a mistake. So we kind of broke up. Then I begged her back, and she took me back, and then she dumped me, and then she took me back right before we graduated from college. We've been together ever since. And about, I think it was either during my senior year of college or the year after college, she bought me the addiction workbook because she realized I had a problem. But I was always in denial. I kept thinking I could quit whenever I want to. And it wasn't until a couple of years after we got married, when she got pregnant with our first son, and we were 25, that I realized, whoa, you know, this is getting real. I got to do something.
You got to do something about it.
Yeah. So I agreed to go to a 12-step meeting with her. At the time, I didn't know what 12-step. I mean, as a kid, I thought Alcoholics Anonymous meetings were places where people could go drink as much as they want to, and nobody would bother them about it. That's what I thought AA was.
Yeah, very different.
I learned as I got older, it's a place where you go to try and get help and support to stay sober. But we went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting in Hollywood. And at the time, because like I thought I could quit drinking, but I smoked weed every day. That was my panacea, you know, my medicine, I guess. I was self-medicating, but I didn't know it yet. And we went to this Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and it was a speaker meeting. And the guy who was speaking was in a wheelchair because he tried to commit suicide because he couldn't quit doing dope. And I just couldn't relate with that, because at age 25, I hadn't tried to commit suicide yet. Yeah. So, and if you've been around 12-step rooms, they tell you as a newcomer or as anybody to try to listen for the similarities and not the differences. But most of us new people are stubborn. And, you know, there's a lot of denial in disease. I was definitely one of those. I went in there looking for the differences. And so there was a huge difference right there. This guy tried to commit suicide. I'm not like him. I'm out. I didn't go to another meeting for a while after that. As it got close to time for my oldest son, my first son, to be born, my wife was worried that my drinking and using was so bad. She's like, you're not going to be sober when it comes time to drive me to the hospital. So I did what they call, I white knuckled it, and I stayed sober long enough to drive her to the hospital.
Do you have any symptoms from that, from withdrawing, any symptoms from not having the drugs and alcohol?
Yeah, the symptoms would be basically being very cranky, restless, irritable, mild insomnia, headaches, not a fun person to be around, what they call a dry drunk, you know?
Okay.
Have you heard the term dry drunk?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Okay.
So that's kind of what I was, because I hadn't discovered exercise, and I hadn't discovered that I was bipolar yet, and I hadn't really embraced the 12-step program. It took a few years. I call them the wonder years, from age 25 to age 30, where I just went in and out of rehab several times. I'd kind of come in, I'd get 30 days, I'd think I was okay. And then I'd be like, I could have one drink, but it was never just one drink or just one hit of weed. I was off to the dope man buying a whole ounce or whatever and just doing it all day, every day until I ran out. A lot of grief with the wife, me trying to hide it, leading my James Bond life or secret spy life where I would go. Say I was going to a meeting, but I'd go get high with my little brothers and then I'd spray on a bunch of cologne and deodorant and put some drops in my eyes and hope that when I went home, I looked like I was sober and try to act sober. And that was a lot of work. I don't miss doing that.
Yeah, that's a lot of strain to put on yourself and then I could bet on your marriage.
Yeah, it was bad. And my wife really thought if I just got sober, everything would be okay. So I actually ended up getting a year sober. I guess when my son was about 2 months old, I really embraced the program and I managed to, I mean, somewhere in between there, I managed to get a year sober. I remember it was May 10th, 2001.
What led you to focus on it for that first year? What led you to get sober?
I went to regular Marijuana Anonymous meetings. I got a commitment as the secretary of this meeting and I actually got a sponsor and started working some of the steps. I got up to the fourth step. That was kind of my MO for those few years. I'd get to one, two, three, and then I'd get on the fourth step and start procrastinating because the fourth step is where you really do your moral inventory and really do some hardcore soul searching to figure out what's the root of why you're, you know, drinking and using. And you write down your resentments, you write down the people you've harmed and you write down other sex misconduct if you have it. But unfortunately, I'm not a sex addict. That's never been a part of my story. I've always been faithful to my wife. So luckily that's not an addiction because I know that's an addiction for a lot of people.
Yeah. I wanted to stop you for a sec.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
for people who are listening who don't know, what are the 12? No, you're good. What are the 12 steps?
Verbatim. Wow. The first step is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol or drugs or sex or gambling, whatever it is. And that our lives have become unmanageable. Step two is we came to believe that only a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And step three is, I can't remember what it is, like basically, I remember that the short version of steps one, two, and three is, I can't, he can, I'm going to let him. So step three was like, we admitted to God that, you know, we needed help, basically. I'm paraphrasing because I don't have
money. No, this is perfect. Yeah, paraphrase is fine. Yeah.
Okay. And there's actually 12 principles behind each of the steps, which is basically like, honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, courage, faith. I can't remember all 12 of them either because I'm ADD.
It's okay.
But if I could pull it up for you, we could look it up later. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. You're totally fine.
The very short version of the steps is steps one, two, three are the surrender steps. This I do remember. Steps four through nine are the action steps. And steps 10 through 12 are the maintenance steps.
Okay.
So in steps one through three, you got to surrender, admit you have a problem, and admit that you need a power greater than yourself, God or higher power, something that's not you, you know, something greater than you. To help you get sober. And four through nine is where you go through resentments and your inventory. And then eight and nine is where you make your amends. You know, those are very important.
Where is relapse most common in the steps? Like where someone might struggle and might relapse?
Most commonly is one through three and step four.
Okay.
A lot of people have a problem with the God thing. And then step four, some people try to rush straight to the amends before they work step one through eight. And I did all that.
Yeah.
I tried to rush straight from step one to step nine, but the thing about it is you kind of break yourself down and build yourself back up and really restore your faith. And you got to have faith in something other than yourself to get sober. For me anyway, I mean, maybe some other people can do it differently, but that's how the 12-step program works for us. We're not a cult.
Yeah. No,
I thought it was a cult join. And I was like, man, what is this? They're talking. I came in and they were saying the God word. And I had a real big problem with steps one, two, and three, because when my dad died and all that went down, I stopped believing in God for a long time. I was basically atheist for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Because I just thought at 13 and for several years after that, if there was a God, why would he do this to my mom, to me, my family? After my dad died, I lost my protector because if my older brother beat me up and my dad found out, he would whoop him.
Yeah.
But after my dad was gone, I lost my protector. So maybe he had full reign to just beat me up whenever. So the abuse got way worse with him after that.
So what got you back to God?
Sitting in rehab when I was 27, I think this is my third time in rehab, and just kind of meditating really and pondering, you know, and I just thought about, you know what, something created the universe and it wasn't me. I'm a science teacher, I'm in science. I believe in the Big Bang Theory, but I believe that there was some sort of divine force, some sort of great omnipotent being that snapped his fingers or whatever, made this Big Bang go off. I don't think it just happened spontaneously, although Neil deGrasse Tyson would argue differently, but I love that guy, but
yeah,
I got to have my faith to keep me sober. I believe there's some sort of creator of the universe. And who could understand whatever kind of how great the power of he is.
Okay. Okay. So you're in rehab and you said you were sober for a year. What happened that made you go back to relapsing? that first year.
This is embarrassing. 10 days after I took my 1 year ship, I kind of started having these thoughts like, well, I've got 1 year sober now. I could probably have a drink. And it happened to be my baby brother's 16th birthday. And the Lakers happened to have just won like another playoff round. And I did so much relapsing with the Lakers between 2000 and 2003 because they were winning all these championships. And I was like, I got a drink to celebrate the Lakers. I remember we were watching the Lakers game. They won. It was his birthday, you know, and hanging around with my little brothers was the mistake because they were still in high school and just started college and they were drinking and smoking weed all the time. Mm-hmm. And there's an expression in AA. They say, if you hang around the barbershop long enough, you're going to get a haircut.
Yeah.
And so I had to stop hanging out with my little brothers for a while when I really got sober. When I first got sober, I really didn't go around at my mom's house because they still lived there for like 3 years. I didn't even go home for holidays or nothing. I just stayed clear of them because they were who I usually drank and got high with the most. And so that relapse lasted a couple months. Now those 5 years from 1999 to 2004 are very hazy. I graduated in 96. I taught in 97 and 99. And then I stopped teaching to go to rehab. I went to a night rehab, like outpatient. And during the day, I was a stay-home dad for the first 2 years. But then after I kept relapsing as a stay-home dad, my wife fired me from being a stay-home dad. And especially once we had a second kid, because second kid came along 2 years later in 2001. So there were a couple more dark years and they're kind of hazy. And I started doing more illicit drugs, cocaine and methamphetamine between 2002 and 2004. And those drugs really kicked my butt.
Yeah.
They're not as, I guess, user-friendly, if that's the right word, as weed and alcohol are. They really take you down into some deep, deep, dark places that I'm not proud of. I ran up a ton of debt, maxed out all these credit cards, wiped out our home equity line of credit. I started getting sticky fingers from families, friends, wherever I could find money to support the habit. It got really bad during those couple of years. And finally, I think it was 2004, I was driving with my little brother, my baby brother, and rest his soul. This disease got him 2 years ago at age 32.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, got my dad at 44. I got him at 32. In AA, they say, but for the grace of God, there go I. So I'm just grateful every day to be alive because I could be dead from this disease too. It's a killer disease. That's actually what helped me get sober when I realized that I have a disease that wants to kill me and that can kill me. Yeah. I think that's what for every alcoholic and addict, when they realize that, whoa, doing this can really, you know, kill me. And it is deadly. That I think that helps a lot of us get sober. I don't think most people don't want to die. Unless they're in a really, really bad place like I was at age 27. And when I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
So you got diagnosed at 27?
Yeah, I think it was after my third rehab. Because that's when I did threaten to commit suicide. And I got put in a suicide tank for a week. That was not a fun week. I don't ever want to do that again.
Oh, I can imagine. That would be so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got diagnosed with bipolar. And you're doing in and out of rehab. Where did you hit rock bottom where you're like, I can't do this anymore. I got to get control of my life.
It was when I crashed that car with my brother in it. I'd been up for a week on speed. And finally, I came down, happened to be while I was driving. We were on our way to the dope man's house because we were out of drugs and we were going to score some more. And he didn't have a seatbelt on. I think he was 16. And his head went through the windshield. He broke his nose and he got a black eye. And that was when I realized that what I'm doing could actually hurt other people. Then shortly after that, my sponsor took me to, he had a buddy who had 15 years sober, relapsed, and died a week later of an overdose. And he took me to his funeral, and he's like, that could be you in that coffin. And then he took me back to my rehab, because I was in full interim rehab. And he's like, do you see all these guys in here? They're just a bunch of dead men walking. And then he went on to say to me, he's like, you know what? You can keep drinking and keep using, because he'd seen me relapse several times. You could die from this disease. And you know what? Your wife will be hurt. Your kids will be hurt. But eventually, she'll find another man to be her husband and to be the father to your children. And when he said that, that just made me angry. I'm like, nobody's replacing me. You know, I grew up without a dad, and I don't want that to happen to my kids. And that was really like my bottom when I just said, God, please help me. Help me not die like other people in my family have from this disease and like so many people do. Don't let my kids become fatherless. Don't let some other man replace me, be the husband to my wife. So that was really when I surrendered and hit bottom and started taking the program really seriously. I made a commitment to do 1 year of rehab and sober living, to work all 12 steps. I made this private deal with myself. I'm like, I'm going to work all 12 steps. And if I still want to drink and get high after that, then I'm going to do it. Because in the rooms, they always say, if you work all 12 steps, the obsession will be lifted. And lo and behold, they were right. I worked all 12 steps.
That's and awesome.
The obsession was lifted. I mean, I think about it every once in a while, but then I play the whole tape through. I'm like, wow, if I take one drink, it's not just one drink. It's another and another. And I'm off to the dope dance. And then I'm, you know, doing all kinds of crazy
stuff. It just snowballs. Yeah.
Yeah, it's bad. So
Wow. And so that through all this, you were still married, you were still being a father, you were still teaching. That is amazing to know that all that still was going on and you had this addiction problem.
Yeah, well, I didn't teach from 99 to 2004. I was in and out of rehabs and in and out of various jobs between then, kind of some labor-ready construction, some substitute teaching, some adult ed teaching, just like I lost a lot of jobs because I'd relapse and then I'd stop going to work. So I had a very kind of checkered resume for those 5 years. But I wrote it off as being a stay-at-home dad for those 5 years, even though it was only two of those years. When I applied for future jobs, I got sober for 3 years from 2004 to 2007. And then 2007, right after a couple months after I took 3 years sober, I thought I wasn't bipolar anymore because bipolar is tricky like alcoholism and addiction too. It's cunning, baffling, powerful, you know, the denial strong. Mm-hmm. So I went off my meds and then I relapsed. I started self-medicating again with marijuana. And I had another 2 month relapse. I finally got sober and have been sober since June 15th, 2007.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. I remember I had the same job at the same school for like 12 years. I actually took a 1 year leave last year and now I'm at a new school this year. But every year I'd be like, I got another year sober and I've been at the same workplace this year. I was always proud. Like 5 years sober, 5 years at the same workplace. 10 years sober, 10 years same workplace. I was always proud. Before I got sober, I was never at any workplace for more than 6 to 12 months, you know, so it felt good to just have that stability, reliability,
yeah,
and be like a dependable worker and a productive member of society. Because for a few years there in my late 20s, I was not a very productive member of society. I was really lost in dark places. And my wife, thank God to Al-Anon, she stuck with me, although she wanted to leave a few times. And I don't blame her.
How long have you guys been married to this day?
23 years now.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. So what got you into becoming a triathlete?
Well, when I got sober in 2004, during those 3 years, I kind of got back into running a little bit, but I was still kind of overweight. I was probably around 230 pounds at the time. And I would run some half marathons, even a couple marathons, but I was running like 5-6 hour pace. And I had run a few marathons in college when I was much slimmer and faster, and I could run in between 3 and 4 hour pace. Then when I got sober, finally got sober June 15, 2007, during that first year, I gained 60 pounds. I remember they told me, they're like, just focus on not drinking and using drugs. And I go to all these 12-step meetings, sometimes 2 or 3 a day.
Yeah.
And they have cake and cookies and all kinds of good food. And I just ate all of that. My boys were still kind of little. They didn't always finish their plate. They weren't teenagers yet. So daddy was the wonder disposal, always clearing his son's place. What they would eat. And I blew up, you know, at 5'9", 200. I remember it was December 31st. 2008, I was a year and a half sober. I stepped on the scale and it said 250 pounds. And I was just like, oh my gosh, 250 rounds up to 300 pounds, man. What am I doing? Because I hated being over 200 pounds. Because at 5'9", 200 pounds is a lot of weight unless you're like all muscle. I was all double XL beer belly, well, cake belly, cake and cookie and fried food belly. So I just got mad and I prayed to God and I just made a resolution to stop eating seconds, you know, eat reasonable portion sizes, start going to the gym every day. And I told myself I'm not allowed to watch TV or play video games unless I've done an hour of exercise that day. That was my commitment. So I had to get off the couch because that was what I was doing. I was just eating and sitting on the couch playing video games with my kids or watching sports. And when I wasn't working, that's what I was doing. And so I just did those three things. Stop eating seconds, start exercising every day. Not allowed to watch TV or play video games unless I've done at least an hour of exercise first.
Okay. What was your first triathlon like?
Well, I did a couple when I was 25, and then I got back into it. That was in 2000, 2001. And then when I got back into it in 2009, I did the same thing I did in my first couple of triathlons. I went there with an old mountain bike and some basketball shorts because I thought I was still a basketball player, and a cracked helmet, and just looked all out of place compared to all these other guys with their aero helmets. And
yes, those bike helmets.
And those tight tri suits that I didn't think I looked good in because I still have some self-conscious body image issues. I went out there, and when I went back in 2009, like, I'm just going to go do it, see how I can do. And I got 16th place in my age division, which I thought was amazing. I expected to finish like dead last if I did finish.
Yeah.
And it was a sprint distance triathlon. It was only like, you know, what was it, a 500 yard swim, a 10 mile bike.
Yeah, that's the one I've done. Yeah. But it's a big deal. It's a big deal. What was your finishing time?
For that, I was somewhere around an hour and a half or something.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I was excited. I'm like, hey, you know, if I actually get a real bike and a real helmet and get the gear and maybe even one of those tight suits, I could probably go faster, get more aerodynamic. I just got the bug, as they say, and just started doing every triathlon I could. And luckily here in Southern California, we have triathlons almost all year round because the weather's nice almost all year round. And I just started doing them one almost every week, and definitely like two or three a month, and got hooked and started doing longer and longer distances. A couple months later, I was doing that half Ironman we mentioned. And then in 2010, I did my first Ironman at Vineman up near you, I guess, kind of Santa Rosa.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my first one back in 2010, and that felt amazing. I remember I was so scared. I didn't think I was going to finish, and I trained really hard for 6 months, and the half the race I was saying the Serenity Prayer and some of the other AA prayers I've learned, and I got through it, and then when I was done, I was like, wow, I'm not even that sore. This is amazing. So then my next thing was, now I got to try and do this faster, because my first one was 12 hours and 40 minutes. And so then I just kept chasing faster times for several years and ended up doing like 2 Ironmans a year for 5 years.
2 a year?
Yeah.
Like a full Ironman.
Yeah, full Ironmans.
Wow. Can you tell people the distances of who don't know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ironman triathlon is a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile bike, and a 26.2-mile marathon run.
That's why I'm like amazed. I'm like, 2 a year. Wow. That is amazing.
But I'm no Iron Cowboy. That guy did 50 in 50 days in 50 states. I mean.
Yeah, that is... That those people blow my mind. Just doing one, and I did a sprint. I'm like, this was exhausting, but you get this bug, you want to do it again.
Yeah, it's
and
fun.
Again and again. It's really fun. It's just great to accomplish something.
Yeah, I know. For a long time, I was out there trying to. And some of those races, they put your age on the back of your calf or somewhere, so you can see when you're in the run course and bike course. I'm like, that person's in my age group. You're trying to go faster and faster. I used to really be into that in my 30s, but now that I'm 46, I kind of like, I'm just racing my own times, and I'm not even chasing personal records anymore. I'm just out there having fun, you know.
So what inspired you to write your book?
All right. That is a very good question. First and foremost, like I said, I was diagnosed as bipolar at age 27. And I didn't start writing the book till like a year and a half ago. I remember it was June 2019. I wanted just to inspire other people who have mental health issues or struggle with alcoholism and addiction, and who maybe struggle with weight issues too, trying to stick to an exercise program. But those have all three been areas that I've dealt with, struggle with, and still have to treat on a daily basis to stay kind of in recovery from them. And I was just hoping if I share my story with other people, maybe it can help other people who might be struggling. That was my big hope for the book, was just to hopefully inspire others who might be struggling with any of those issues, to let them know things can get dark, but things can get better, you know.
Do you ever talk to your kids about what was going on with you? Or do you ever worry about your kids having the same, you said it was like kind of a hereditary thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I do. Yeah. I pray a lot about it. You know, they're both in college and they both, you know, at least dabble with alcohol and weed that I know of. So hopefully they're not like daddy. I've taken them to meetings with me when they were in middle school and high school, and they've heard my whole 45 minute talk and my whole story. So they know a lot of stuff that I went into, you know. So when I first learned, as far as I know in high school, I mean, they must have hid it from me. I don't think they did it in high school. If they did, they didn't tell me about it. But I know they started in college, and I was a little worried at first. I think a lot of people do it in college. And hopefully it's just an experimental thing for them. Hopefully the gene's not passed on to them. We'll see. Time will tell. They're only 19 and 21.
Okay.
So,
yeah, because that can be like a major worry, because you don't want to see them go through what you went through.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, my middle one, I did learn he had started dabbling with that vaping marijuana towards the end of his junior year in high school. We found out during his senior year, and that was really concerning. And we actually tried to make him go to meetings for a while, and he went to a few, but he's pretty angry about it. We'll see. Hopefully he'll be all right. He seems to be doing okay. Only time will tell. The one thing I've learned about being an alcoholic and addict is, if you are an alcoholic and addict and you really want to get recovery, you actually have to accept that you are one, and only you yourself can really kind of diagnose yourself as an alcoholic and addict if you're going to really recover and get help. So I hate to label other people that.
There's stigma, but it's awesome that you got help, and so many people don't get help. I used to work in psych as a rec therapist, and I would work with addicts all the time and would do the rehab stint. It was hard because it was like a revolving door. You see them come back over and over and over again. And a lot of the guys would tell me, they would say, it's so difficult. Marijuana, heroin and crack and all that stuff is really hard to get. You have to kind of go and look for it because it's illegal. But alcohol, you can just go to the store and get it. Or how do I stay sober when what I'm struggling with is so readily available to me?
Yeah.
And so just teach them, because I would teach them other things they could do, like go running or to try this sport. You can replace it. But it was just so hard. It was hard for them to grasp that. Some guys finally did, and then some sadly would pass from it. The addiction is just... People are afraid to talk about it because there's shame behind it, but it's really, really damaging to people's lives. It's great people are talking about it more, like saying, yes, this is a thing. This is a disease.
Yes.
Treat it as a disease instead of shaming.
Yeah, that was another thing that I think helped me, because I didn't think it was a disease, but in rehab, they taught me that according to the American Medical Association and the World Health Organization, for anything to be classified as a disease, it only has to have three criteria. It has to be progressive, chronic, and fatal. And I'm like, yeah, this is definitely progressive because each time I relapse, it gets worse. It's chronic because every time I do it, I'm doing it all the time. And it's fatal because I certainly came in a few close to death situations and a lot of people overdose and die and DUIs or whatever. And So I'm like, it's definitely a disease. And once I accepted it as a disease, then it wasn't so much it's just mental weakness or lack of willpower. It's, you know, this is a genetic thing. So that helped me kind of embrace that, to be able to ask for help, because it's not just mental weakness or something.
And for people who may not be addicts themselves, but have family members who are, what's some tidbits or hope you can give them how they can help their family member who's struggling with addiction?
Well, that's such a tough question. My number one piece of advice is to go to Al-Anon or Nar-Anon or one of those 12-step groups that's for the family members of alcoholics and addicts. I know that saved my marriage. If my wife didn't go to Al-Anon, we probably would still be together. They have things that they do. They learn how to love and detach and how to realize that even though they're alcoholic or addict, maybe doing some really bad things, they're just a sick person that's not well. And inside is a good person that wants to be well. They're clouded by the disease of the drugs and alcohol, and they haven't figured out how to get past it yet. They haven't hit their bottom yet. I would advise them to pray for them to hit the bottom and to let them hit their bottom. Because if you keep getting in the way of them hitting the bottom, making things easier for them, it's going to take them longer to get sober. So you got to let them fall. It's hard, but you got to let them fall. Yeah. And if they're ever going to get better, and some of them don't. Like one of my wife's friends, her son just died in overdose and he's only 24. And they've been in Al-Anon together a long time. And she just started going to more meetings. She was actually on her way to a meeting when she found out. And she kept going to that meeting because she knew that's where she needed to be with other people in Al-Anon, a family support group, to talk about it. That's my advice, is go to the Al-Anon family group support groups.
Okay. And then what are your goals for you this year? I know this 2020 has been kind of a mess.
Yeah.
What are your goals? What do you see for yourself with your book and with your message that you're getting out to people?
Let's see, with my book, I'm just hoping to get the word out there and help and inspire others and maybe sell a few more. I'd love to do some type of virtual book tour, but I haven't got that organized because last year I took a 1-year leave and I was pursuing some career change alternatives, but mostly I ended up focused on writing the book. Now I'm back to teaching again, so I'm pretty busy, I guess. Towards my racing goals, I got a team together and we applied to be a part of the next Eco Challenge because I was one of the many people who watched the Amazon series. Was it the World's Toughest Race, Eco Challenge?
Yeah.
I was 5 minutes into the first episode when I hit pause and started Googling, when's the next race like this? I want to do one of these. and it turns out that they had a 2-week window where you could apply. Like the series came out on August 1st or somewhere in the beginning of August. And then the deadline was August 15th to September 1st. You could apply. So I quickly put on Facebook, who wants to be on my team? And I met some other people that wanted to do it. And we got a team together and we put in our application.
Awesome.
Because you have to make a video and you have to fill out all these. You have to fill out this long questionnaire. And for the one they had in Fiji, there were 1,000 teams that applied and 66 got accepted for the race. Now for this next one, which we don't know what the date will be because of COVID, but there were 5,000 teams that applied because everybody watched that series. And a lot of us were like, that looks like fun. Let's go do it, even though it's crazy. So hopefully we'll get into that. And that probably won't be until 2022 now with COVID. Yeah. The other thing I signed up for is the Tahoe 200 miler. It's a 200-mile endurance run. Kind of up near you.
Yeah,
it's north of here.
I love Lake Tahoe. I love Lake Tahoe. Like north side or south side?
It actually runs the whole Tahoe Rim Trail. It'll do a huge loop around it. It's 200-mile endurance run. You got a 100-hour time limit.
Wow, that's so cool.
That's in September, and that's going to be my next biggest challenge because I've done 700-mile endurance runs, and this will be my first attempt to go that crazy distance. So that's a big goal.
Wow. And then my final question for you is, when did you decide that you were brave?
I think the day I published my book, because then I was like, whoa, you know, because honestly, like I said, I got diagnosed by bipolar at 27 and I didn't want to tell anybody at work. I was still ashamed of it. I was a high school teacher. I thought if my students found out I was bipolar, they'd just think I'm crazy. I thought if my principal and the administrators found out I was bipolar, they'd feel like, as you hear stories about mentally ill people going postal, I thought they might think I'd do something like that. Although I'm a very pacifistic, nonviolent person. I only told my close family members and a few close friends about it. And I usually didn't even share about it in 12-step meetings. For 19 years, I kind of hid behind it. You know, I guess the day I became brave is when the day I published the book, July 1st this year, because I'm like, oh no, now everybody's going to know it's public information. So
yeah. How has it been received? People knowing about your diagnosis and your history?
I think a lot of my friends who already knew my story, they've been supportive and they bought my book. And I've been on several other podcasts. I've gotten feedback from people I don't even know through social media who bought my book. And they're like, I love your book. It's really helped me out. I can relate with this. I have mental health issues too. Bipolar people, we have depression and anxiety. And so they're like, I struggle with this too. And I'm like, well, we're all here together. I've joined all these different support groups through social media for, you know, because I basically, this book has turned me into an advocate for mental health now that I'm not hiding behind it anymore. I guess that's my brave now.
Yeah. And it's such a good thing because there's also stigma with mental health and people hide it. And then within hiding it, mostly you end up hurting yourself. It's just better to talk about it. It's a disease. If someone has cancer, you treat that. Mental health is the same thing. It's another disease. You just have to treat it and you get better. And
I know, shouldn't be ashamed of it. I've been doing more research about mental health. I know I fundraise and support for NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Health. They say 1 in 4 American adults have a diagnosable mental illness because there's so many different types of mental illness. A lot of people can have just depression or anxiety. So I just, you know, if it's 1 in 4, you got to know, like, there's a lot of, and especially with the pandemic right now, it's probably 4 out of 4.
You know, I work in a children's hospital and we've seen a lot more people come in with those symptoms.
Cabin fever. And then just with all the misinformation out there on social media, I don't know if you watched that Social Dilemma documentary that came out recently, but fake news travels 6 times faster than real news. So we got all this information circling that people are spinning on. And it's just like,
It makes you anxious. It makes and you need an outlet. And it's just, it's been kind of a mess. All right. Well, Tim, thank you so much. It's been great. And can you tell people the title of your book and where they can get it? And I'll put this in the show notes too.
Yeah. Hey, the title of the book is Tripolar, The Story of a Bipolar Triathlete. And you can get it on Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, Apple Books, Book Depository, Indie Books, a few other places. If you go to my website, ultratimdavis.com, there's a list of all of them there. Or if you just search Tripolar Tim Davis, it's the first thing that pops up on like Google and Amazon and Apple Books. And it's available in paperback, ebook, Kindle, and audiobook.
Hey, Tim, thank you so much. This has been so great. I'm glad we got to hang out and hear your story.
Yeah, thanks. It's always good to talk to other fellow Californians.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I am so thankful and grateful for all of my listeners. Your support means the world to me. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day to tune into my podcast. I love you guys all for it. Okay, here are my 3 asks. Ask number 1 is, of course, share the podcast. If you hear something today that you are loving and you would think would benefit another person, feel free to point them to our podcast and share the episode with them. 2nd is ratings. If you're loving what you're hearing, if you have any suggestions, ratings really helps me understand what I'm doing well, what I need to work on, and I appreciate and love the feedback that I get about the podcast from you guys. I really appreciate it. And then finally, subscribe. So subscribing is kind of interesting right now. You can subscribe at my old website, which is www.apeachandcali.com. I have a new website, which is www.braveoneministries.com. I am still figuring out the email subscription list for that one. If you want to subscribe over at Peach and Cali. That will be live until about March 4th. I'm going to take all those emails and put them in the new one. So you can subscribe there. And then when I figure out how to use MailChimp so you guys can subscribe to my new website, I will let you know and you can start subscribing over there. Again, thank you guys so much, and we will see you next week for a new episode. Bye.